Uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. The future is here, if you can pay for it. From NFTs to Web3 to virtual worlds, it seems like everyone has a pitch about what the future looks like and how we get there. For those involved, it's a frenzied world of big money and massive opportunity. From the outside looking in, a lot of it looks like a massive scam. Now, when I was a kid, the future meant flying cars and virtual worlds of our own creation. Now people are telling me it means clunky headsets, pictures of cartoon apes, and decentralized platforms that make absolutely no sense, but will make those involved filthy rich. What the hell is going on? With me today to figure it out is Motherboard Managing Editor Jordan Pearson and special guest Jackson Palmer. Palmer is perhaps most famous for creating the Dogecoin, but he's also a musician, a programmer, and the host of the excellent new show, Griftonomics. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Jackson, for those who don't know, can you tell us about your background and the brief story of Doge?
Yeah, I've been, I guess you could say, a very online person for most of my life. And back in the day, was involved in several web projects. But in around 2013, a bunch of my friends were getting into Bitcoin and Litecoin and all that kind of stuff. And I made the joke about Dogecoin, which very quickly turned into a real thing also as a joke, and then kind of got out of hand. So I was involved in that for really a short period of time in the grand scheme of things, kind of left Dogecoin in about 2014, actually, shortly after it was created. And that first time was really, I left because I'd seen a lot of the scams and the problems that were in crypto. And I was like, okay, like it basically validated why I made the joke. And, you know, since then, I've come back a couple of times, first in 2017, 2018, to build a YouTube channel, trying to educate people about cryptocurrency, focus on the technology instead of the speculation. That kind of took off, but not really, versus the people who were shilling investment advice. So disappeared a little bit again. And then more recently, I've come back because I find that kind of as you were alluding to, it's not just about crypto anymore. I think we're living in this kind of age of grifting, this age of fraud, especially online.
So can you tell us then a little bit about this new project that you've got, Griftonomics? What's it about?
Yeah, Griftonomics, it actually started as an idea well over a year ago when I originally bought the domain. And the kind of format is really not just focusing on cryptocurrency, but every episode focusing on something that people may be hearing a lot about, like a shiny object. But if you dive deeper into it, kind of uncovering the grift of that thing. And so, you know, we've done episodes on Web3. We've done episodes on the metaverse. The idea of selling free speech, which seems to be a popular thing right now. And, you know, just recently today launched an episode about carbon offsetting and carbon credits, which, you know, is a topic that I didn't know a lot about. But again, you scratch a little bit at the surface and you find out that it's uber grift. And so it's really about just shining light on a lot of these things. And as I was saying, I think these day and age, because we're so digital, because we're all so online, a lot of people are more susceptible or maybe more exposed to grifts than they might know.
So what's your opinion on, say, picking a random name out of a hat, Elon Musk, and how he's connected to this topic?
I think he is obviously, you know, a big proponent of certain cryptocurrencies and plays a role in kind of the hype cycle that is attached to it. You know, there's, for instance, I know for a fact that a lot of automated trading bots, you know, place trades based on whether he tweets with certain keywords. I think what's important to note, though, is that he's not the only one. He is in many ways, I think, somewhat of a pawn for the real promoters of cryptocurrency, the real promoters of some of these grifts, who in my mind are, crypto exchanges, people who really will make a profit of it. In my eyes, the richest man in the world isn't looking to make a buck off some crappy altcoin. It's probably somebody else that's putting, a whisper in his ear to talk about that thing so that it benefits them. So that's how I kind of think about it. As I said, it's the exchanges, it's the VCs that are very invested in this stuff, pouring billions, the Andreessen Horowitzes of the world, that kind of thing.
So it feels like where we are right now, not a day goes by that Motherboard doesn't report on something like this, something that you're talking about, some new crypto that turns out to be a scam, somebody that gets hacked and loses everything in the NFT market. Is there something about tech right now? And you kind of alluded to it earlier, saying like we're all living very much more online. What are the kind of the underlying conditions that have created this world where it feels like it's a constant grift and scam?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually had Maxwell from Motherboard on the other day, and we were talking about this. I think there's several things that have kind of propped up, that have kind of led us to this world of hypercapitalism, where it's really just a focus on money, money, money. And the world has always been that way, or at least it has been for a couple of centuries. But I think more recently, especially because of the pandemic, I think there has been isolation that has occurred. People are feeling less and less about, the well-being of their collective, and more about the well-being of themselves as an individual. And I think to some level, that's okay. I think everybody has to look after themselves and make sure they're exercising self-care in that way. But I think the unfortunate side effect that is being exploited by a lot of these kind of scams and frauds is that it kind of has bred a moral nihilism, a world in which, because there is not this kind of collectivism happening anymore, you're not seeing people, you're not feeling empathy for other people as much day to day. I think people have been pushed to a point where they don't care if, their neighbors, or even in some cases their family, loses money on something, so long as it's okay for their back pocket. And I think if you go back 5 or 10 years ago, I don't think we could have lived in this world, because I think there would have been just kind of a societal shame in acting that way. But I think people don't care anymore. As I was saying, they're nihilistic about, who cares about the collective good, so long as, I'm able to make a buck.
Do you think that any of that has to do with, I'm thinking of like the Douglas Rushkoff idea of the way that we interact with each other has changed so much, and so much of human communication relies on all these kind of subconscious things that we don't take into account. Like when you're like, you and I are looking at each other across a Zoom call, we can see each other's face. There's all sorts of like expressions and things that happen. So much of the way we interact now, all of that has been stripped away. Do you think it's easier that part of it too kind of makes it easier?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think if you go back, and I've done some of this research for the podcast, if you go back and look at grifts, they've existed for as long as money has, as long as markets have. I think they used to be a lot harder to facilitate, because a lot of it had to be done in person. You had to sell your snake oil in person. If you go back to even the MLM days of kind of Tupperware and cosmetic parties and things like that, you had to gather people physically in a house to try and sell them into your pyramid scheme. And so the hurdles were there. In addition to that, those schemes were typically carried out with just regular old US dollars or the existing banking system, which had a lot more regulatory oversight. And so I think we're in a world now where, in addition to, chat and TikTok and a lot of these kind of really seamless digital methods allowing people to connect with much larger audiences than they could have over for a Tupperware party, combined with the fact you now have cryptocurrency, which, unfortunately has acted as a way to, as a kind of rail, in a sense, for unregulated finance. And so you have this thing that is unregulated, easy to hide, shady kind of things that you're doing behind. And you have mass audience now through digital kind of methods. I think, yeah, it's just rife for this kind of scam.
It's funny. I hadn't thought about crypto being kind of the perfect vector for this stuff because it is unregulated. How much are not just the American government? I think we focus on America because I live here. Jordan may not live here, but he works here. Mm-hmm. We look at the West a lot. In what ways are the governments dropping the ball?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there is a perspective that cryptocurrency in many ways is still a niche thing. And I was hoping that, like, honestly, when I started the Griftonomics podcast, I was hoping not to cover crypto too much. But as you scratch kind of at the surface of these different grifts, you know, whether it's the metaverse or even carbon offsetting, believe it or not, you'll always find a crypto angle. It is parasitic in that it is cryptocurrency tries to find synergies with other, you know, scams so that it can kind of have longevity in a way or extract value. And so with carbon offsetting, for instance, you know, there's several blockchain projects that are spinning up to sell carbon credits, basically turn carbon credits into a casino through a blockchain. I know it's mind-blowing. Not to mention the person that's leading this is Adam Neumann of WeWork fame, who has started a blockchain carbon credit. You know, Andreessen Horowitz thought that it would be a great idea to give him, you know, a lot of money again. So all of that aside, that's just my way of saying, I do think that crypto is actually a lot more pervasive, but in a way that a lot of people don't think about. They don't know that it is this underlying rail that a lot of these other grifts are using to power. As for the government, I think they've fallen victim to the same thing as the mainstream population, and that they haven't seen this really kind of happening behind the scenes. And I think the other side effect or the other problem is that lobbyists have really become hugely powerful when it comes to, you know, maintaining the unregulated nature of cryptocurrency. The multiple run-ups we've had over the last decade have given these exchanges and these venture capitalists huge war chests that they're able to dive into and then use to put money in the back pockets of politicians who then go and the lawmakers who are trying to write these regulations. And so while I do think that there may be a step towards greater regulation in the coming years, I think it's going to be defanged in many senses due to the fact that a large swath of politicians that are writing this regulation probably have, you know, in many cases, maybe undisclosed crypto investments or are receiving campaign financing from the exchanges and venture capitalists promoting cryptocurrency.
There was just
I know you were talking about non-US. Oh, sorry. Did I jump in?
You did, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, something just happened like within the last 24 hours that's relevant to this discussion, which is, you know, the new legislation that was put forward by Senators Gillibrand and Loomis, who, you know, Loomis is a very like pro-crypto politician. She bought Bitcoin in 2013. In terms of like who's dropped the ball,
she had eyes in her Twitter bio, right? Yeah, she's one of those people.
Yeah, she's a laser eyes GOP politician. I mean, like, because I've been like, you know, covering crypto since the days when Jackson was still in crypto. So like, you know, it's hard to not to see that like the ball has already been dropped. Like, you know, like the SEC is now trying to like play an unwinnable game of catch up with like, because basically the way that's like the securities designation in crypto has worked like and still works is that no one really knows if something is a security until the SEC suddenly says that it is. Like there's been no like, you know, like law that says like this or that is definitely a security, except for like whether or not your lawyers tell you that it passes the Howey test or not. And like there's all kinds of justifications that people have come up with to say that.
Back up. Tell me, because I don't know what the Howey test is.
Yeah, the Howey test is a test to see if something is a security, and it's pretty simple. It's like, you know, are you buying something with the understanding that you're going to like profit from it due to like the efforts of someone else. So that would be like, you know, shares of a company, or it could be like tokens in a project that's like promising they're going to make a game. So your tokens are going to be like really valuable later. So, you know, this has been going on for like almost a decade now, and without like strong guidance from the SEC, except for like this, these sort of like piecemeal rulings, like we're now in a place that like the horse is kind of out of the barn. I don't know if that's a mixed, the proper metaphor, but like the cat's out of the bag in a sense. Like there are like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of crypto projects that, you know, are probably, if the SEC was going to take a look at it and make a ruling, are probably securities. But now we're in a place where like we're trying to legislate around this, but you know, it's already everywhere. So this like new bill that is on the table basically is saying that Bitcoin and Ethereum and probably most derivative cryptocurrencies are not securities. They're not regulated by the SEC, but they're commodities that should be regulated by the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So commodities like oil or gold. And this is kind of like a dream scenario for many in the crypto lobby, because then all of a sudden that means that the securities regulator is, you know, not looking at their shit, basically. It's funny because like I think many Bitcoiners would probably have a meltdown at the idea of like Ethereum being a commodity as well as Bitcoin, because they tend to see like Ethereum as like the OG shitcoin that's actually a security, but you know, they pretend it's not. But we're now in this situation where there's a law on the table where Ethereum would be considered a commodity like oil or gold along with Bitcoin, like precisely because essentially regulators have sort of sat on their hands for basically the entire decade that
I think it's important. Like I don't have a lot of faith in the US law system of pushing that forward. We'll see if it actually ends up making it into law. But I think it is important to note that the one of the people that wrote that legislation or the proposal, Loomis, is very much what some would call a Bitcoin maximalist, is very much in that camp. So it's no surprise to me that proof of work currencies, for instance, like Bitcoin, would receive that kind of commodity designation in this framework. I do think it will get a lot of pushback, though. I think that, yes, it may be okay for Bitcoiners, but you know who's not going to be a fan of this? Exchanges. Because their entire business model, the Coinbases of the world, is predicated not necessarily on Bitcoin transactions. Not a lot of people are trading Bitcoin speculatively. They're trading, you know, crappy cat coin, meme coin stuff that will probably be, you know, a victim of this legislation. And so I think you'll actually see some counter lobbying from the big exchanges, Coinbase, FTX, Kraken, et cetera, against some of this legislation. That's probably what will hold it up, actually, is you can't touch the coffers. You can't touch the business model of these large exchanges.
All right, we're going to pause there for a break, cyber listeners. We will be right back after this.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
All right, cyber listeners, thank you for sticking around. We are on with Jackson Palmer and Jordan Pearson, and we are talking about how everything feels like a grift right now online, in the crypto space especially, but in tech in general. Before we jumped off, we were talking about new regulations that are coming down the pipe. Question for both of you, you know, a very simplistic, I think, reason that I had always felt that nothing was being done in the regulatory space was not just that the lobbying money, but also the fact that many of the American legislators are old, and perhaps don't have backgrounds in tech, don't understand this technology. But then I do see things like this new regulation coming down the pipe. And then also, you know, recently the first insider training around NFTs was that case is going forward. Do you think there's any traction to the idea that we've just that this stuff will get better as younger people enter, you know, the legislature, or are we kind of doomed?
I don't have a lot of hope, which, you know, and I honestly hate to have to take that kind of cynical, pessimistic view of this, but I think being a decade into this or more without any real traction, to me, I don't see a lot more happening. I think even as younger people come in, I think most politicians are going to be swayed primarily by what their funding is aligned with. And I think especially these younger candidates coming in, I think they might even, you know, given that they're probably starting from a position of less power than some of the incumbents, going to be even more aligned with where their campaign funding is coming from because they need it to stay relevant and in power. And so, you know, if there was a new wave of, new lawmakers coming through, younger lawmakers that were taking a very vocal anti-crypto stance, then maybe I'd have a lick of hope. But I just don't see that really taking shape. And honestly, mind you, I think there's honestly just much larger societal kind of issues happening right now that, you know, in many ways, I'd probably prefer that those lawmakers actually spend their time on fixing before we go and fix crypto scams. I hate to say that, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, there's probably more important things. It's kind of one of those things that you just wish the system would pick up as an obvious scam. And, you know, this wouldn't have to even be a conversation, but unfortunately, there's a lot of money involved.
I agree that it's not going to go away for those reasons. Like, you know, Loomis is not a young person, but she's probably the most pro-crypto politician out there. So I don't even know if it's a question of age. I think it's, you know, Jackson, you've mentioned that crypto is hyper-capitalist, while so are legislators, particularly, you know, often Republican legislators who are, you know, very into this stuff. I think it probably, you know, as regulation advances, it probably will get better. I don't think the scams are ever going to go away 100%. Just, you know, that's impossible in my opinion. But I think it would be nice if I didn't see like ads for something called Unicorn Coin plastered all over LaGuardia at like baggage claim, you know, like hopefully stuff like that will go away.
I think the other thing that makes it a lot harder is this kind of insidious kind of behind the scenes thing that happens is that crypto has this way of attaching itself to use cases that people would be then less likely to try and dismantle. So, you know, there's this common thing in crypto where they say, well, crypto is helping bank the unbanked. It's helping pull people out of poverty in Venezuela, often without, you know, in any way, you know, substantiating these claims with evidence. You know, there's also a lot of puff pieces you'll see about these people, these homeless people in America, or these people in a lower socioeconomic rung were pulled out of poverty because they could gamble on random ape NFTs. This is a great thing. And I think that those kind of stories and that narrative disincentivizes politicians, but also even leaders in the tech industry from calling these things a scam because they're like, oh, but it's helping the poor Venezuelans. I'm going to be seen as a jerk if I go and say this thing is bad. I think that's even further reinforced by, I think it was last year when the infrastructure bill slipped some crypto stuff in. I saw organizations, nonprofits like the EFF, for instance, really campaigning against crypto legislation to the point that the EFF, I think, was retweeting Ted Cruz, who was against the legislation as well. So I think also just institutions or these nonprofits that we have thought in the tech industry are on our side in the past, like the EFF, have been thoroughly infiltrated and thoroughly turned into pro-crypto lobbying organizations that are going to stop some of this stuff. Because I think a lot of people like in the tech world are like, EFF, they're good guys, right? But no.
It's interesting you mentioned EFF because I feel like, obviously like civil liberties orgs are great, but a lot of like the pro-technology groups, I feel, are kind of explicitly like techno-libertarian, really, mm-hmm. when it comes down to it, including, you know, the famous essay that sort of started it all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's crypto really does align with that. Like, it's like, well, if you're a libertarian technologist, crypto is right there. So it's interesting because I feel like the logic of all of this has been embedded in kind of like the California ideology. Probably forever. And it's like, well, of course they're supporting this. Like it lines up completely with everything that they've always been about. But it's interesting that now, you know, there's sort of these lines dividing. I think
they used to be able to kind of make the excuse of, oh, that's an edge case. Oh, like, the Venn diagram was such that, like, on most things we agree with the libertarians. So even there were, you know, people who were more left leaning in California were like, I'll put up with some of those kind of fringe libertarian beliefs they might hold, because overall, like privacy, lobbying against Facebook, these are good things, great. But I think what's happening now is some of those things that were previously fringe are becoming more and more, you know, center to the belief systems of these people. And I think, honestly, when you get into this with, you know, progressive, you know, lefty tech people who just aren't aware, they're like, whoa, I had no idea. Like, you go and you talk to them about, you know, some of the Timothy May stuff. You talk to them about things like assassination markets that, as you were saying, have been around for a very long time in the kind of libertarian tech world as concepts, but brushed under the rug. And they're like, whoa, I had no idea. I thought we were all just, you know, trying to care about data privacy or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I thought we just had a crypto crash. I thought everything had been wiped out.
Right?
And that, yeah, but you know, the show launches kind of after the Griftonomics kind of launches after it, and the stories don't stop. We're still hearing tales of these, you know, $1 million hacks, $13 million hacks. Did the crash have no effect on any of this? Did all of that money getting kind of wiped out not slow any of this down?
I don't think so. I think that the reality of that crash was that it was primarily caused by, you know, the Terra Luna situation, which I'm sure you might have covered in the past. But I think it was a little bit of a blip. It was a little bit of a wake up call for some people in crypto. But the reality is that crypto crashes all the time. And it gets resurrected by huge investments of additional capital from VCs, because they know that they're not going to be the ones that are losing money. The people that lost money in these crashes are the last people out the door at the end of the day, right? Everybody who got in early is still sitting on a war chest from, you know, 6 to 12 months ago when things were looking good. And now what you see, you know, whether it's, you know, them firing up kind of Terra 2 or whatever they were calling it, just as a blatant way to come back from that. Or you see this new fund that I know Andreessen Horowitz are now investing in, putting more money into things like DeFi and DAOs and things like that. It's just creating another funnel, knowing well, like full well, that there is another round of suckers to get in to kind of extract wealth from, right? And some of those people will unfortunately be people who didn't learn their lesson the first crash. They'll be like, oh, now I'm actually $20,000 in the red. Maybe I will take out another loan to try and make that up, right? It's really a kind of a gambling addiction, in my opinion. But then there's also people who may not have been exposed to crypto before, who will come in for the first time. And there's just, it's that whole kind of greater fools theory, right? And you need a lot of money and a lot of hype, a lot of Matt Damon ads to get more people through the front door. But I don't think there's a shortage of fools, unfortunately. And because of that, I think, yeah, crypto crash, I unfortunately don't think it's over.
Jackson, I'm curious what you think about, because I mean, you know, we talked about like Andreessen Horowitz and their $45 billion investment in Web3, like post crash. Mm-hmm. You know, no secret that they were also like a large funder of like Web2 Silicon Valley companies that like now are kind of like the villains of like, you know, lefty sort of tech circles. Like, I mean, what's the connection there? Like, in terms of like the idea grift or like, you know, just sort of the hyper-capitalist bonanza and where it's moving now. Like, you know, what do you see a connection there? And what, in your opinion, is
absolutely the connection? There's a huge connection. I think it ultimately comes back to the fact that billionaires don't have souls. and I think that there's just there is a lot of moral gray area there, an ethical gray area where, you know, venture capitalists will typically go to whatever they can make a buck on, right? And in Web2, you know, they basically helped fund an infrastructure that has, you know, violated our data privacy, sold our data to data brokers for the last, you know, decade or two decades, and made a lot of money off that. One thing I think is interesting, the Web 2.0 era of startups, while it did make some money for venture capitalists, it wasn't surefire money. We're all aware of all the failures that happened. There's a lot of cases where, you know, companies like, you know, or Andreessen Horowitz or other, you know, Sequoia, other venture capitalists, they 90% of these startups fail and they don't make a buck, right? So I think that's important to know. In the old world, I think the thing that is so appealing about Web3 to them is Web3 is set up in such a way, cryptocurrency is set up in such a way that they can have almost 100% hit rate where not a single one of these investments fails. The way it used to work is that you'd put some, you know, you'd give a company a few million dollars and you'd sit around and you'd hope that within a few years they'd have an exit. They'd be acquired by somebody else, or, you know, you'd have that pipe dream of an IPO so that you'd actually be able to reap the money from your investment. Web3, and I should say, as I said, 90% of those would fail. With Web3, every investment that a company or organization like Andreessen Horowitz are making, they can build in at a hugely discounted rate tokens that they receive from a pre-mine, you know, and whether that is tokens in a DAO, you know, some sort of NFT kind of thing, there's always a scheme, but they can make it such that as soon as that thing launches to the public, they're already able to dump and reap their initial investment capital, but also a huge profit on top of that, 10 out of 10 times. And so to me, I think, you know, Web3 is, you know, the Web2 kind of grift, but amplified to a point where it is a surefire bet. And that's why I think they're putting so much money into it. Right. Because there's no way, and this sounds crazy, but there's no way that it turns out as a bad investment for a company like Andreessen Horowitz, because each of the bets that they're making, they've already built into the tokenomics of that thing a way that they can dump and recoup, at the very least, recoup their investment, if not make billions of dollars off the bag holders who are going to have to buy the tokens at the public price that's maybe 10x what they paid.
With the UST collapse that we mentioned, like, you know, an example that comes to mind is because UST like went to zero, people's lives destroyed effectively. Sure. They were VC backed, you know, investment firms pumped millions of dollars into it. And after the collapse, I remember one of those firms, Pantera Capital, came out and was like, "Don't worry, everyone. We dumped all of our tokens on investors at the high. We're good." Yeah. And it's like, okay, that's terrible, but I'm glad you made money. You know, maybe in a more typical sort of investment scenario, they would have gone down with the ship if they didn't have an exit opportunity. But because these are tokens, you know, they feel free to just sort of exit at any time, and their liquidity is retail.
Exactly. They just dump on retail investors. But I think here's the crazy thing to me about that is that I don't think there is anywhere near enough backlash from the retail investors who got dumped on to actions like that. And it's because I think there's this like strange belief system where if we think of this as all just one big digital casino, that they're just the better poker player. Like in that case, you were saying Pantera were just the better poker player. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to get angry about that because maybe one day I can be like them, you know? And that's the dream that everybody is sold on, right? So I increasingly have seen when these kind of, you know, morally dubious kind of actions take place, like big venture capitalists dumping on retail investors, there is a, honestly, hardly any backlash against them because everybody thinks that every crypto day trader right now has a secret dream that in 3 years they'll have their own fund, you know? And it's kind of sad. But,
I mean, you want to, the idea is like you want to do what they're doing. Like you want to get in early, you want to use as much money as you can to pile up, and then you want to exit at the at the high. Like that's the game for everybody, whether you're Andreessen Horowitz or whether you're just a random person. But like at the same time, I feel like there is a group of people in crypto who are very against this, and that's Bitcoiners. And like in my mind, I feel like there's still an asterisk of like between like Bitcoin and crypto, and like whether or not that's like really true, like I part of me is still like, are we're just in like the longest alt run in history. And like everything that we're talking about maybe 5 years ago would have just been alts. We would have just used the word like alts to talk about them. But now it's like, it's crypto. But to the Bitcoiners' credit, who are often like, you know, half right about things and then take that to like an extreme degree, you know, I think a lot of Bitcoiners in particular see the VC stuff and just correctly in most cases see like impending disaster, basically.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think of the it's an interesting observation, and it's absolutely true, is that I think it's more the kind of post-Ethereum kind of era that is more of this kind of speculation, you know, penny stock kind of behavior. You're right. A lot of Bitcoin maximalists will really call that out. At the same time, if you look into kind of the Bitcoin maximalists, you know, I think of them more like gold bugs. Like I think a lot of them have kind of this whole prepper mentality. And there's a certain type of, I would say there's a certain type of people that are attracted to Bitcoin and have continued to be Bitcoin maximalists. It's funny because I do agree with them on a bunch of stuff. But at the same time, then you look at the other stuff they're posting on their Twitter and you're like, okay.
I feel start like talking about guns and then things get a little weird.
Yeah. You're only allowed to eat raw meat, and you have to eat it off the top of an assault rifle. That's the Bitcoin diet.
Sorry. The image stuck in my head for a second. I was thinking about I think it's Ted Cruz has got the ad where he's cooking bacon on an AR-15.
Oh my God. It's real. Okay.
Funny. Cause that guy's Canadian.
Yeah.
Never forget. Ted Cruz is Canadian.
Never forget he was born in Canada. Yes. Nationalism tends to be born on the fringes of a society. I think Father Coughlin, famous 1930s and 40s fascist on the radio in America, also Canadian.
We don't talk about that one. We don't talk about Ted Cruz either.
You've got some – there's some strains. I've talked to some interesting people in Canada that also – There's some strains. We can talk about it off air. Putting that aside, I've often thought that one of the reasons that this stuff doesn't get regulated as much as it should and isn't looked at and scrutinized as much as possible is because it feels like it exists in a separate economy. Yeah, you know, aside from, you know, the people that are getting on the roller coaster and getting taken in, and aside from like seeing unicorn coin ads when you're boarding at LaGuardia. Is Bitcoin, you know, are these speculative markets driving up the price of gas? They don't seem to be. Do you think we'll ever get to a point where that is happening?
I think, you know, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, it's on the fringe. It's something that is in many ways siloed and air gapped from affecting the real world economy. And I was happy for that back when that was the case. I think increasingly, you know, with the kind of game stonks kind of period that ensued recently, and Robinhood and other apps, you know, I think PayPal have now integrated it again. allowing you to kind of, you know, day trade on crypto assets at a scale that previously wasn't possible for a retail kind of investor, with a very nice user experience, a really easy mobile app. I think that there's a lot more exposure than there was 3 years ago from the average person. Furthermore, I think a lot of funds, a lot of investments, you know, people's 401ks, for instance, I think are increasingly getting exposed to crypto in one way or another. And I think that is also incredibly dangerous. I saw a news piece this morning, or I think it was that Senator Loomis actually saying that people's, you know, retirement plans should, you should make sure you have diversified into Bitcoin. And I think that's just such a dangerous thing. And so if people are getting more exposed to, you know, in the mainstream to crypto through those means, I worry. And that was one of the things I was, when the whole Terra Luna collapse started to happen, I was like, wow, could this start having ripples back into the mainstream economy? I don't think it imploded enough yet to see that happen. But when the big bubble pop does happen, I it will be interesting to watch. It's interesting. Like I know that I've been looking into FinFluencers or TikTok influencers, who are doing finance stuff. And
it's a wild world.
I recently saw them suggesting things like put all your money into this DeFi protocol and then use that, the money that you've borrowed from this DeFi protocol to take out a mortgage on two or three houses. And so I worry that a lot of real world kind of capital could be caught up in this kind of weird system that's backed on these protocols.
I mean, just last week, I think it was the British Treasury put out a consultation paper where the Treasury proposed that the Bank of England, in the event of like a stablecoin failure that threatens the wider economy, that the Bank of England would essentially take over as an administrator to ensure that it continues.
Wow.
So, you know, whether or not a stablecoin will ever become so popular or integral to the economy that becomes necessary, I think that's an open question. And in my mind is like probably somewhat unlikely still at the current moment. But that is something that the British government at least is putting out there, that, you know, in the event that a stablecoin pops, the government will actually work to make sure that it continues.
So the future is like that. That like the irony of a crypto stable coin requiring a bailout from a central banking system or a government, given that, you know, the invention of crypto and was tied to a protest against or supposedly tied to bailouts. That's just to me is like, that's such a flaw in crypto if that's what it has to rely on. But
it's crazy. Pretty mind-boggling for sure.
Governments to a certain extent want to insulate people, certain kinds of people, from the consequences of their actions, right? And so when something fringe reaches a certain asset class, let's say, then it becomes incumbent upon the government to step in and make sure that asset class doesn't get hurt too bad. So I think that would be, Jordan, I think that's a pretty bleak and telling example of where things are going. Because it certainly doesn't, like, I thought for sure, and Jordan, you knew better than I did, I thought for sure the crypto crash, you know, GPU prices were coming down, everything was going to be fine, this is all going to work itself out. It's not. It's just, you know, this kind of thing requires geometric growth, more people are going to get taken in, there's a gambling aspect to it. You always think you're going to be able to get on and make a quick buck if you're a small time bag holder, and doesn't sound good.
Yeah. I mean, the VC money is just piling in now. Like the engines are still just starting up in terms of like, you know, the same types of people or the same firms in some cases that propped up, you know, a lot of those like Web 2 companies, like we talked about before, that are now kind of seen as villains. Like, that's all kind of pivoting back into crypto now.
I see it as not just starting up. I think 2021 was, I think, VCs kind of dipping their toes in the water to test whether they could extract a lot of money and then get out. And I think it was a success for them, at least. It wasn't a success for all the people that are now in the red because of the crash. And so this new injection, I think in many ways, is just round two for both them and for their buddies. Mm-hmm. They've gone and said, hey, we did this. It worked. You should get in on it as well. So I think it's far from over.
All right, Jackson, I think that's a terrifying place to end. You are cataloging all of this. You are talking about it all the time. Where can people find the show?
Absolutely. You can find it at griftonomics.com or twitter.com/griftonomics. So we release weekly, and I hope people are getting some value out of it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming onto Cyber and walking us through this. And if you like Cyber, we are often streaming the show on Twitch. Go to twitch.tv/motherboardtv, where you can watch the show as a live broadcast. And of course, as always, we are available wherever fine pods are casted. Leave us a comment, drop us a line, rate the show. We love you all. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back a little bit later this week. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.